Tonight we're going to be talking about intentional friendship in marriage. And this is a topic that we haven't talked about a lot in previous years, but just strikes us that we are counseling way more couples who have only been married for a year or so, and they're saying, coming in, we really still love each other, we just don't like each other, so we're going to divorce. Or they are committed to the covenant of marriage, so they stay married, but they say, we're committed to stay married until death parts us, but we just don't like each other, so we're just going to live parallel lives. They don't use that terminology, but that's what it is. We're just going to each do our own thing. And both of them miss out. And we're especially thankful for the college age tonight, because you may think friendship and marriage, you're not married. But these principles hopefully will help even as you think about that, because I am convinced one of the reasons we have such a hard time in friendship is a lot of people get, when they meet each other, they become involved romantically very quickly. They get involved physically, they fall for each other, and they never develop a friendship. They just develop this chemistry that we must be right for each other, because everything is fireworks. Then they get married. Sort of the rain comes, the fireworks subside. And so that chemistry that kept them together isn't quite there, but they never develop friendship. And so they don't have this sustaining friendship. So we want to talk about how we get it, how we keep it in marriage. So let's pray. Father, thanks for the opportunity to be together tonight, and even in this rain, we are aware that you are the one that with a word changes the storms and settles the dust and stops the wind. And so we commit ourselves to you tonight in full dependence of your power, and acknowledge your goodness to us. In Christ's name, amen. I want to talk about seven areas today in the whole area of friendship. The first is the importance of study. Continue to be a student of your spouse. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as a weaker partner, as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Another translation says, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. Get to know your wife. The question here is, how well do you know your spouse if you're going to develop that friendship? Early in a relationship, it's very easy and natural to get to know somebody, to want to find out about them, but often that wanes as a relationship goes along.
In fact, I'm even thinking about the college students in our midst tonight, and if you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, I'm guessing that nobody is having to remind you to make sure that you're considerate of them, or that you take time for them, or that you make sure that you check in with them. And probably every one of us who is married, if we go back to the beginning, will remember that what came so naturally, that was so effortless, that was sort of like breathing when we were falling in love and even in the early part of our marriage, hasn't remained quite so natural or so easy. The reality is that once the massive and natural production of oxytocin, which is produced by our bodies during infatuation and early love, once that subsides, because it's non-sustainable for life, we really are left with the challenge of either being very intentional to continue to study our spouse, to invest in each other, to prioritize our relationship, or it will be crowded out by the craziness of the world in which we live. All the tyranny of the urgent will overtake our thoughts and our actions, and pretty soon we can be living in a logistically convenient relationship, but one which really lacks friendship and vitality and verve. We've thought about this a whole lot, since this is kind of what we do, is encourage people to stay married. And so we've studied relationships for a long time, and we actually have reflected on our own marriage of how easy it was in the very early days of dating to think of nothing but one another. The story I'm going to tell you tonight took place actually on our very first official date. Paul and I had been introduced as friends like 8 months earlier, so we spent the first 8 months that we knew each other just developing this great friendship. Paul is much older than I am, so the thought of a romantic relationship wasn't even on the radar. Just 4.5 years. Just we'll settle that right now. Anyway, so it was 8 months into our friendship that I get this typewritten invitation in the mail. Now, for some of you, you can Google it when you go home. What is a typewriter? Or you can go to a local museum and you'll see them there. But that was the way that we communicated. It actually came in a letter, through the mail, stamp. It was just amazing. This invitation said, I'm inviting you to go on a date with me to the finest restaurant in San Diego with the finest company, 7 o'clock on Friday night. I'll pick you up at your parents' house, which is where I was living. It was during college. So I was so excited about this evening. I had no idea where we were going. Paul picked me up at my parents' house in his 55 Ford station wagon, which was old even then. And as he walked me to his car, before he opened the door, he said, there's just one thing I'm going to ask, and that is, I'd really like to blindfold you because I don't want you to see where we're going. Oh, yes. So the intrigue raises, and I just want to give a caveat, and that is that if you don't know the person very well that you're going out with, and they suggest blindfolding you, say no. All of you college students. But I felt like I really knew his character. I had no concerns about this. I let him blindfold me. Off we drove in his 55 Ford station wagon, making only one stop en route to our final destination. As we made this one stop, he said, sorry, I just have to go back by my apartment because I forgot something. Which, looking back on, was a harbinger of things to come. But I kind of just let that one pass as I sat in the car blindfolded. We continued on. We eventually made it to where we were going. He said, you can't take off the blindfold yet, though. I have to make sure our reservations are set. I can hear him taking things out of the car. I honestly had no idea where we were or what he was doing. Eventually, though, he opened my door and, still blindfolded, led me somewhere, and then he said, okay. He took off the blindfold, and we were standing on Sunset Cliffs in North San Diego. Some of you know where that is. A beautiful area of hardened sand dunes overlooking the Pacific Ocean just before sunset. And before me was set a card table with a tablecloth, candles, two place settings, a little cassette tape recorder, which was blasting the sounds of the Carpenters. Like, it just could not get any better, okay? As I sat down, he began to serve the first course, which was salad. And he said, before you take your first bite, I just need to tell you something. He said, I heard you say that you really love avocados, and I've never bought one before. So I don't really know if they're supposed to be soft or hard or what, but I got one, and I hope it's okay, but if it's not, I'm sorry in advance. Well, upon taking one bite, it was confirmed that he did not know how to pick an avocado. It was hard, and it was tasteless, and it didn't matter. I was so amazed that this guy had paid attention to a passing comment, I like avocados, and then he had filed that away so that on this night, he would remind me that the things that I said mattered to him. And that he paid attention and then did something with that information. I really wish that I could tell you in all 36 and a half years of our marriage, I have responded with such grace and generosity in what we've now called the avocado moments of our marriage. When I know that the gesture is good, the heart behind what Paul is doing is right, even if it doesn't deliver. But I would be lying if I told you that I was equally generous throughout our marriage. And there are times when I don't even say a word, but I have somehow communicated, really? Like, what were you thinking? Or worse. And as we have considered this first point of continuing to build into the friendship of our marriage, this knowledge curve is one that's critically important that we never leave behind. That one, it's a continuing endeavor that we will study each other, that we'll listen to each other, that we'll pay attention to what one another is saying, and then that we'll actually act on that information. But then thirdly, when the gesture is made, even if it doesn't hit a home run, but we trust in the heart of our spouse, we extend grace rather than judgment. These are huge keys to continuing to develop a vital, life-giving friendship in our marriage.
Lise, can I tell a story on you? Thank you. Okay, so Lise was going with a guy, and they'd only been going together for a few weeks, and it was before Christmas. And so she said, you know, he's coming over for Christmas. We're going to have a dinner, a bunch of us. And I don't know if I should get a gift, but she said, I decided I would get a gift, put it in the bedroom. Then if he came and brought a gift, then I'd have a gift for him. If he didn't, I would not bring out my gift. And so they weren't sure how long, you know, they hadn't been going together very long. So he comes in, he has a gift. And we said, well, what did he give you? And she said, he gave me an onion chopper. Well, I just said, cut your losses, man. I would have said that, except I saw the smile on her face. And I said, tell us more. She said, well, a couple weeks before, I was cooking dinner for Fellowship of Christian Athletes. He came over early, and I'm crying. And she says, I hate cutting onions. He went right up again. Good guy. He wasn't good enough to sustain, but he was good for that. So that's another story. How well do we know our spouse? I have a friend who in his wallet has a card, has his wife's favorite flower, favorite color, blouse size, shoe size, you know, just everything. Anytime she says something I like, he just writes it down. Why? Because he's continuing to be a student of his wife. Carrie and Gabe, our oldest daughter and son-in-law, staying with his parents for a while in Granite Bay. And we were speaking there, and we wanted to thank the parents for allowing us to stay with them. So we're at Costco, the best store in the world. And so we're getting flowers, and I said, Gabe, would your mom like flowers? He said, oh, she would really love that. She'd appreciate that. Carrie wouldn't. I'd never get them for Carrie, but my mom would. Well, in 5 short years of marriage, he knew that Carrie doesn't like cut flowers. She thinks it's a waste. But his mom loves it. So it's how do we know our spouse? The second thing is not only knowing something about this person, feel free to close anything before we take off. That door does shut right there. Yeah. Those of you that are staying in tents, just head to the beach when we end here. Don't go up canyon. Okay, never mind. Don't all leave. Second, once you know something about a friend, real friends that sustain themselves, do something about it. In John 13:15, after Jesus has washed the disciples' feet, he says, now that you know these things, you will be blessed. And then those last critical 4 words, if you do them. Blessing doesn't come from knowledge. You can know everything about your spouse here. You can know everything about what Jesus did. The blessing doesn't come unless you respond to that. We met with a couple earlier this year, and they were struggling in their marriage. And the wife said, I just do not feel cherished. We often ask a wife on a scale of 1 to 10, how cherished you feel by your husband. Husband on scale of 1 to 10, how respected you feel by your wife. We asked her and she said, you know, maybe a 1. And so tell us why. She said, well, a birthday is a big thing to me. I really like celebrating my birthday. And we've been married for 35 years and he's never been there for a birthday of mine yet. He's a medical doctor and he's never shown up. And I've said, you know, I really would love to have you take me out to dinner, you know, be home with me, but he's always had a conflict for 35 years. Now, you know, there are conflicts that come But you know, something I've discovered is that Virginia's birthday is November 5th. Every year, it's November 5th. Why, it doesn't sneak up on you and go, oh my goodness, who changed the date? You know, it's always November 5th. So this guy, for 35 years, had, you can't do that without saying to your wife, I really don't love you. Why? Because she had said it would mean so much to me. So he was actually in worse shape because she had said this would mean a lot to me than if she had never done that. He knew it and didn't do anything about it.
And so this is at the very heart of marriage that works is sacrificial love. We've talked about that a variety of ways this week. And what is true is that love costs, doesn't it? We live in a culture that keeps telling us to do our own thing, to take care of ourselves, that my happiness is the only thing I really need to go after. And the messages of our culture begin to sound right to us the more we listen to them. The message of Christ is just very counter to that. Many of you probably were taken at least somewhat with the Tim Tebow frenzy of the fall. And I read an article, came over the internet towards the end of the season, and it was written by a woman who identified herself as having been married 15 years to her husband who loved football. She said, I hate football. And throughout 15 years of marriage, my husband has begged me to just watch a few games with him on a given Sunday. And she said, I've always resolutely held my position that I hate football. I think it's a big waste of time, and I'm not doing it. And then she writes, until this season. And then she said, Tim Tebow came on the national stage of the NFL. And she said, I was so caught up in Tim Tebow's bold proclamation of his faith that I said, I don't care what Tim Tebow does, I'm watching him do it. So she said, I am watching football now. And I read that, and I felt kind of sick to my stomach for her husband of 15 years, whose request that she watch football with him was never good enough. But Tim Tebow's presence in the NFL brought her right in. And I thought to myself, isn't that true of us in a variety of ways, that someone else asks us to do it, we're willing to make sacrifices. Many of us do a lot with our kids that we don't particularly love doing. But it's pretty hard for us at times to make a sacrifice to come alongside our mate and say, even though this isn't my favorite thing, I love you, and so I'm going to do this.
We had a couple come this year to visit us at camp, Lou and Grace Charette. They're on our staff some 30 years ago. We were in, 25 years ago? Immaterial. But we were in their presence when they had been married for 30 years, and Lou said to Grace, for the first time in her hearing, I've never loved you. A little awkward for us to be in the room when she heard it for the first time. They split, and humanly speaking, they never should have gotten married. Lou was raised in orphanages, foster homes. He had a very, very tough upbringing. He was rough and tough, independent. He was a large equipment diesel mechanic. He loved drag races. He loved rodeos, anything that's dirty, and that was Lou. Grace was Dutch in every way. She liked tea parties. She liked quilt shows. She liked craft shows. And so they split for a year and a half. Longer story, but they came back together. We were with them after they came back together at the Nutcracker Ballet in Boston, and it was intermission, and so I went up to Lou and I said, so Lou, you like ballet, huh? And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, I love my wife. And that's the answer. He thought about ballet like our youngest daughter, Julie, when we said, how'd you like the Nutcracker? She said, oh, it was okay except for the dancing. Lou hated ballet. But see, Lou goes to craft shows and quilt shows, and Grace goes to drag races and rodeos. Neither of their tastes have changed, but their love has. And that's really what's gonna keep a friendship going. They don't go all the time, but if one says, wow, it'd mean a lot to me, and I'm sure women do this, but I can't tell you how many men say, I'm not doing that, I don't do that. instead of said, well, she said it would mean a lot to her. Why don't you do it? So it's knowing and then doing something. Thirdly, be intentional. Pursue common focus and interest. Matthew 19 says, the two become one, they are no longer two. You know, they become one. This is a process of becoming one. And there are too many couples that have lost the intentionality. If I had paper up here, I'd draw three circles. When you get married, there is the husband circle, and then there's the wife circle, and they overlap, right? Then those little boogers come along, right? And they, what do? They physically try to push you apart, don't they? You're hugging, they get in between you. They're a tool of Satan to separate husband and wife. And so next you have husband, children, and wife, right? We had a couple here recently that went on their 25th anniversary. They were given a 25th wedding anniversary, and they took their children. I said, that's sick and wrong. Why? Because Satan won, you know? Because they didn't want to be, well, she didn't want to be with him. She wanted to be with her children. And what happens when they drop out, which is what they're supposed to do? You're hanging and you don't know each other. And that's why that's the third time, there are four statistical times that couples divorce. And the third one of the four is when your children leave. Because you've done everything for them, with them, talked about them, they're your life. And we had three children, we still do. We like them, we like hanging out with them. We have one of them with us right here, we love her. So that's, okay, on to point four. Pursue your friendship, pursue your marriage. You have to do it intentionally. Because otherwise, there are all these good things that creep in and you start drifting apart.
And the reality of life is that anything of value, anything that I value, I invest in. Isn't that true? In fact, it's actually one of the ways that you know what you value is take a look, take a snapshot over this last year and say, what have I invested in? Where has my extra time gone? What have I really pursued? And it's going to tell you an awful lot about what you value the most. And that's why we keep coming back to the priority of the relationship of marriage. If we're not really intentional about this, it's the story of all too many marriages where the children, where hobbies, where professional pursuits, where extended family, where fitness, you fill in the blank, all good things, but if given a higher priority than the marriage relationship, will eventually deal a death blow to the marriage.
We had a couple come see us a few weeks ago. They were sort of Barbie and Ken. I mean, they were incredibly good looking, perfectly fit, but they were drifting apart because they never had time for each other. But they said, and life is so full because we each are at the fitness center for 2 hours a day, and they just sort of going through their day. And I go, so you're each at the fitness center for 2 hours a day, right? Yeah. So you're going to be the most fit divorced couple you know, right? Because you value your fitness more than your marriage. See, it can, and that's not a bad thing, you know? Fitness isn't bad. My wife wouldn't mind if I was more fit. It's a good thing. But if it gets in between the marriage, it's not a good thing. So go whatever it is. Facebook. Can I say a couple words about Facebook?
Yeah.
Just, we have time for this.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we've been really sober to the realities of the potentially destructive nature of Facebook when we heard the statistic earlier this year that 1 in 5 divorces are citing Facebook as a primary contributing factor in their divorce. reconnecting with a high school friend or just chatting it up with somebody that they develop a cyberspace-based relationship with. And if that's not bad enough, and I think that there are many pitfalls, obviously there are some good things about Facebook, so we're not condemning it wholesale. But we are saying that we have to be pretty vigilant to put really strong safeguards around our involvement in Facebook or any other social networking site that we might be involved in. And even if we completely avoid the pitfalls of an illicit relationship or an inappropriate liaison or anything else, the question we all probably have to ask ourselves is, what is it keeping me from doing? I mentor a lot of young moms who don't have time for their quiet time, they don't have time to keep up their houses, they don't have time to really plan the meals, they're always scattered and crazy. But they fall into the average American Facebook user, which has Facebook on 6 hours a day. Yes. Now, it's not saying that they're sitting there glued to it for 6 hours a day, but it's saying that it is on their computers open, just in case something comes through. 6 hours a day, that's the average for Facebook users. Is that enough?
If you have to tell somebody you're at Starbucks, there's something wrong with your life, I'll tell you that. Get a life. Okay, now, on to number four. Be committed. The covenant relationship is more than circumstances. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves, what is that? Oh, at all times, not just when it's easy, not just when it's fun, not just when it's pleasant. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. It's so easy for us to fall out of this covenant relationship, this commitment, because it's not as fun anymore. We were counseling a couple, and the man said, my wife just isn't any fun anymore. I mean, we used to go out drinking every weekend and partying, and she just was so fun. And she says, we have 3 children. She says, yeah, and you're no fun. She says, grow up, become an adult, be a father. Well, see, a lot of people are splitting because the circumstances aren't. I had a lady who said she was leaving her husband because he was boring. That was her reason. I hate to tell you, but biblically, you can't substantiate that. Boring isn't one of the reasons that God ordains divorce, allows divorce.
And so we know that those of you who are married have a pretty clear concept of the covenant, that by God's design, marriage as a covenant relationship is a for keeps relationship. God's idea about marriage is not at all in sync with 21st century, especially American, but it's certainly all the way around the world, belief about marriage, which is that it's really much more contractually based than covenantally based. And as a result, we have a very disposable attitude towards it. The divorce culture was born in the 70s, and it is alive and well today. On the first pass, we were told in the 70s that divorce doesn't hurt kids, that they're resilient, that they'll get over it, that they're better off if their parents are happy, even if their parents are happy not living together anymore and divorced. Well, one of the books that we've carried in the bookstore this summer, I didn't mention it this week because we're down to one copy, but the book is entitled The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce by Judith Wallerstein. And I'll just tell you, for any of you who would have any fleeting thoughts of divorce or thoughts that linger, or you have people in your life who are contemplating divorce, beg them to read this book. It's the only longitudinal study that's been done on the effects of divorce on kids. 25 years. It's a landmark study done by Judith Wallerstein, who is a Jewish social psychologist, and it is just statistical reality of the effects of divorce on kids. The name of the book is The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce by Judith Wallerstein. And the reason that book is written is because we have left the idea that marriage is a committed relationship for keeps. So especially again for you college students who are not married, for any of you in this room that are not married, as you consider the idea of marriage, don't take your cues from a culture that has gone far, far from God's design for this, and see that as you enter this, the reason it's such a critically important decision is because by God's design, it's for life. And he tells you exactly what he expects of you in marriage before you get there.
And we're aware, in a room this size, some of you are divorced, have suffered through that, some not at your own choosing at all, because of repeated infidelity and repentant infidelity or desertion or abuse of some sort. So we're not talking about the fringe. We're talking about the majority of people who are leaving just because they're not quite as happy as they used to be. I think in the church today, in fact, I think we wouldn't say we endorse divorce, but I'm amazed how many of us empathize with people. And hear this really, if you're falling asleep, hear this clearly. But I think often somebody will say, my husband, and people say, oh, that's too bad. And they just sort of start buying into it instead of say, well, you better work on your marriage because you're in it for life. I think even in the church, we start saying, oh, it must be horrible living with him. And we start sort of strengthening their case. We're counseling with a couple who came in, and often it's the woman who's more dissatisfied with the man. But in this case, it was a man who is more dissatisfied with his wife. And he says, I don't know if I can take being married to her anymore. She just does not really understand what loving me looks like. He says, she doesn't feel that we should have sex at least every other day. And she won't do anything I ask sexually. And I don't know if I can continue in a relationship where a wife would make a man go for 3 days without sex. I said, I know what you mean. Well, to tell you how this went, he and I were standing yelling at each other at a point. Because I told him what I thought of his statement. We ended up sitting down, had to finish the session. 3 days later, we got an email from a man. And it was in response when Virginia and I had spoken in Granite Bay in the Sacramento area a year and a half ago or so. We spoke, and a man came up after to talk to us, and he said, I agree with everything you said, but he said, I have just a question. He says, I'm not arguing with you at all. He says, but my wife struggles with chronic depression, and she's been in and out of mental institutions. She cannot respond as you have challenged wives to respond. What am I supposed to do as a husband? And so Virginia quickly thought about two men that we know who have had their wives were in exactly this situation. So we wrote them, they emailed back. Here's just a little portion of an email from one of the men who has been married for 35 years to a woman who struggled with severe depression, in and out of mental institutions. And it says, and what God has called together, he doesn't want broken. I would be lying if I said that the word divorce never entered my mind, but it never really did enter my thinking. Vows are vows. In the dark night, sometimes our thoughts go to the idea that we might be better off if only we could flee the marriage. But in the morning, standing and staying is of God. And by staying, you have honored God in ways that perhaps are more noble and glorious than any of the Christian leaders you might deeply admire. Honoring your vow is a deep thing that God has asked of you and placed upon you, and by honoring it, in your own small way, you have been helping God's kingdom come to life here on earth. Because a vow has been kept in a world that treats vows like tissue paper, easily shredded and torn. Kept vows build God's shalom like very little else does. There's an old story of an older missionary couple that came back to the States on a steamship after a long and faithful career serving God overseas in an invisible manner and without much reward. They were at the rail of the ship as it came to its berth, and there was much fanfare and commotion there on the dock to greet the famous dignitary who was coming home. The old man mumbled something to his wife about how they weren't getting any kind of a welcoming or recognition. His wife paused a moment and said, "But honey, we're not home yet. One day you'll look at Jesus in the eye and he will know what you have done, and he will look you in your eyes and whisper, well done. Not perfectly done. Lord knows how imperfectly I've handled this calling he has put on me and the things I am ashamed of and the failures that I know and carry. But one day you'll be home and all things will be made right. One day, so keep hoping. This world is not all there is. This world is upside down. But one day your wife will be fully alive, and so will you. One day, so keep hoping. It's a great statement. As you live in the messiness of the present, keep hoping for the wonder of the future. It is beyond what you can imagine, so keep hoping. Here's one man ready to leave his wife because they're not having sex every other day. Another man whose wife would probably go years without being able to respond to him in any meaningful way. And he said, but I made a vow. Love is loving sacrificially. And none of us know when we say yes at the altar what that's going to look like. For some of us, the challenges are going to be more significant than others. But for all of us, the vow is the same.
And again, we do want to affirm that there are some situations where divorce is a lesser of two evils, or where a couple does have to live separately because of abuse. So we know that through the history of the church, there's sometimes been a presentation that it's a no matter what, just hang in there if you're getting beat up or whatever, it doesn't matter. We don't believe that that's of God. But again, that just doesn't describe most of the situations where divorce is being pursued. It's just so often that my needs aren't being met in the way that I wanted them to be met, and so I'm going to find that someplace else.
Fifthly, be honest. True friends are honest with each other. They don't keep secrets from each other. Ephesians 4:25 says, put away falsehood and speak truth each to each other.
There's probably nothing that's more impacting to the marriage relationship or to a friendship than this whole area of honesty. And even though we live in a culture of dishonesty, truthiness was the word that was coined by Frey in his book A Million Little Pieces, after it came out that great autobiographical accurate account of his life was really just sort of true. And those are the times in which we live, and it can affect our thinking very, very easily, in convenience or avoidance of pain or avoidance of consequences or whatever it is. The enemy's going to constantly be playing on us to compromise the truth. The reason that we long for marriage, and again for you that are single in the room, the reason that you want to get married in a world in which marriages are failing at an alarming rate, and those which stay together, there are an awful lot of those that aren't really experiencing the fulfillment that any of us would have hoped they would have in marriage. So the reason that you're even thinking about marriage is because God has placed marriage in our heart, because we were designed for relationship. We were designed for community. So the very thing that we long for, unless we're absolutely committed to being honest and telling the truth to one another, we'll actually never experience, because true intimacy is really only experienced in honesty. It's the commitment we make when we enter this covenant that I will love you till death do us part. I'm going to choose that. We're going to probably have to work through some hard things in our marriage, but I'm committed to being known by you and to knowing you. It's said that that's the deepest longing of our heart, is to be known and loved and accepted. And we get that from God. We understand that he knows everything about us, and it doesn't compromise his love for us. And the marriage relationship offers us the greatest potential of experiencing that on earth. But for all too many of us, we allow the culture to reshape our thinking or to distort our thinking on this, and we decide that what they don't know, well, what happened in Vegas stays in Vegas, and as long as it's not the Smiths who live in Vegas, then all the rest of us are going to be okay because we just left it there, right? At our Engagement Matters weekends, we always have one session in which we talk about this whole concept of genuine soul intimacy. How do we get that? Because that's what everybody wants. It's the soulmate thing. And so we hit pretty hard on this. You have to be committed to truth-telling. You have to be committed to those hard moments where you have to confess to one another. And we're just telling you on the front side of this, don't walk down that aisle hiding secrets from one another. Because what you will be plagued with then is the question, would they choose me if they knew? And you don't want that question to go with you into your marriage. Well, it was after that weekend, many years ago, we got this lengthy email from one of the couples that attended. And she started it off by saying, that was a really tough session for me. I'm 3 months from my wedding date. She was at that time 28 or 29 years old, so she had waited to get married. She'd found the man of her dreams, a godly, wonderful man. And she said, I sat there in that session knowing that I had some pretty significant stuff about my past that I had never told him. My rational mind, I continued to say, he doesn't need to know it. I've already transacted that with God. I've laid it at the foot of the cross. Those things happened when I wasn't really following Christ. I've been forgiven by God. It's been washed as far as the east is from the west, my sins and all of this. She kept going over, and all of that was true. But she said, as I sat there thinking, I had to be honest with myself and realize that the real reason I hadn't told him was because I didn't know if he would still marry me if he knew it. So she said, that night after the session, I said to him, I have some things I need to talk to you about. And she said, it was the hardest thing I've ever done because I knew that in doing that, he maybe would call off our wedding, which we always say in that session, that is one of the things that could happen, but better to find that out before the altar than on the other side of the altar. So she said, I'm weeping, I'm blubbering out this stuff. I couldn't even look at him when I was telling him. And then she said, I finally finished, and then I looked up, and I was shocked to see tears running down his face. And then he said, well, if I'm completely honest with you, there are a few things that I need to confess to you also. And she said the next part of our evening was him telling me the things that he had been holding from me, wondering if I knew those things about him, would I want to marry him? And she said it was the most amazing moment of grace for them to agree that they had been fully forgiven, that they were not the people anymore that they were years earlier when they had done those things, that God had done an amazing work in their lives, and that they would choose to marry each other. They've now been married 15 years. They have 3 kids. God is using them in great, great ways. But I've often thought of what would have happened to them if they'd both walked down that aisle with the big question, if they knew, would they still? And so those of you who are married, like, this is kind of late for you to be hearing that. I get that. And many of you walk down the aisle feeling like you were fully known, but you haven't continued to be fully known. And we just want to beg you to take really seriously this truth, that if you want to experience the fullness of soul intimacy in marriage, you will have to be committed to continuing to be truth tellers, to continuing to be open and honest, to continuing to be transparent with one another. And to the degree that you are not, you will compromise your intimacy.
Sixthly, practice affirmation. Be an encourager. Hebrews 13 is talking about how we are to encourage each other as brothers and sisters in Christ. And it says, but encourage one another, how often? Daily, as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. This whole thing of encouraging each other is so, so important in friendships, so important in our marriages. I thought of a gentleman who said, I married a cheerleader and then found out I got a critic. We tend before marriage to be the cheerleader, to be the one, I love being with you, I want to listen to you always. And then after marriage, something changes. Are we encouragers of each other? And, you know, I just don't think most of us respond to constant criticism, nagging, you know, just what's wrong with you? Why can't you? That sort of thing. It is encouragement that helps us, I think, much more along this way. I think this would be a true statement. I don't think there's any, it sounds almost arrogant, but I don't think there's anything wrong with me that Virginia hasn't already told me is wrong with me. Do you follow that? I mean, I don't think there's new news that she'll say, you know, this. I'm like, oh, wow, never knew that. You know, I think she's pointed it all out. So to continue to do that, I just want to remind you, this is still wrong with you. I don't know, just as a man, it's only, you know, I've had most of my experience as a man, so that's all I know, but I don't respond, I don't go, oh, I love it when you nag and when you criticize and when you show me what a failure I am. That really motivates me, because I don't know what it is. In the marketplace, when a man fails, he digs in, he works harder. In the home, when he's told he fails, he says, okay, I'll quit. I don't know any man that when he's told by his wife, you just can't do it, says, okay, I'll work harder. Most of us say, okay, fine, you do it. I can never do it right anyway. So encourage one another daily. So critical in our friendship.
And it's really believed that for most of us as couples, we probably like about 80% in the person that we've married, and there's 20% that we're really hoping is going to change over time. And for many of us, we spend 80% of our time talking about the 20% that we want changed. And as a result, really whichever side of that equation you live in is the one that's going to grow. So we see it, at least in our office, there are an awful lot of very weary couples who feel like, it is true that the stereotype is that for most men, they sort of give up, they sort of don't have a heart that they're ever really going to get it right. I was going to say something really wrong. Well, every once in a while, I'll say to Paul, well, honey, if you did it right, then I wouldn't have to say that. But the truth is that if we are focused on being the home improvement committee, whichever gender we are, we will likely over time dishearten our mate. And we'll send to the next generation kind of a disillusioning view of marriage. I personally think that's the reason that the rate of cohabitation is the highest it's ever been in the history of record keeping. If you read The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, you'll realize that that culture, those 100 families that were followed for 25 years, the vast majority of those kids don't have confidence that marriage can work because they didn't see it work. So this whole area of encouraging and affirming, again, probably came very naturally during your courtship, your dating years, your early marriage years. But if that's going to continue to be a life-giving fount in your marriage, you're going to have to be pretty intentional about making it happen.
But there's another side. We don't just encourage each other and just blindly always say, oh, you're wonderful, everything's great. Because we know each other more than anyone else, and so we have the opportunity to encourage growth in each other. I know Virginia better than anybody knows Virginia. Virginia knows me better than anybody knows me. And with that knowledge, this passage says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. It's true in marriage as well. Because of that knowledge, with that sharpness, we can either help sharpen each other or we can stab each other. And we need to sharpen each other. For us in our marriage, how we take criticism from each other is a barometer to how well we're doing in our marriage. When I am confident that Virginia loves me, I'm feeling really respected by her and loved by her, she can point out things and I'll say, well, thanks so much. Really appreciate you helping me. If we're in a bad place, she points out a minor thing. Why are you always on my case? What's the difference? When I really sense she's for me, I can take criticism. When I don't think she's for me, I don't take it at all. Some of you know the name Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback that's ever lived. I officiated at a wedding this summer in which Tom Brady was one of the groomsmen. And so I asked him this question, which I had been telling this last year as an illustration. And so I thought, wow, what a great time to ask Tom himself, is this story true? And the story is that when Tom was in eighth grade, a man named Thomas Martinez started helping him learn how to pass. And from that point on, Thomas Martinez was his passing coach. He had a lot of official quarterback coaches in high school and college, in the NFL, but Thomas Martinez was always the one that he really tuned into. And the story was that after every game, no matter what level it was, he and Thomas would talk, and Thomas would criticize his passing. He would critique him. And he'd welcome it every time. And so I asked him, I said, is this true? Thomas Martinez died a few months ago. And I said, is this true that every time he called, even when he was critical of you, you welcomed it? He says, absolutely. And I said, and is it true the reason you welcomed it is because you know Thomas was totally for you? I mean, that... Yeah, Thomas Martinez was totally for you, and he only wanted what was best for you. He said, absolutely. You see how that works in marriage? If you know that your spouse is for you, then when they try to help you grow, when they say, you know, Paul, picking your nose in public when you're speaking is detracting. You don't go, no, it isn't, you know. You say, thank you. Why? Let me consider that. Because you really believe your spouse is for you. The last point, grow old and enjoy memories together. You know, it's great to have friends that have been friends their whole life. They've just kept this up, and there's no other relationship where this should be more true than in marriage, that we grow old and really, really love each other and love being together. Some of you have been with us over the years where we've talked about a couple, one of our favorite couples, Claude and Forrestine Cole. And if you've been with us, you know that they chased each other around buck naked at 80 years old. And that's their claim to fame story. And it's actually written in entirety in the back of Before You Save the Date. And when that book came out, I went and told Claude, I read Claude this story. I said, hey, Claude, I want to read you something from a book I just wrote. And I read him the whole story, and Forrestine had passed away by this time. And it was almost a holy moment. Claude just sort of leaned back in his lazy boy rocker and reminisced. I don't know what he was reminiscing about, but he was reminiscing about good times with Forrestine. And I thought, you know, they developed that over their life. Forrestine had Alzheimer's the last few years of her life, and we traveled an awful lot. And Claude said that Forrestine would say, could we go and see Paul in Virginia? He'd say, I think they're traveling. 20 minutes later, Claude, do you think we could go see him, Paul in Virginia today? And so finally he said, I'd just get in the car and we'd drive and by your house, and nobody was there, and I'd say, Forrestine, I'm sorry, they're not here. One day we were there, and so they came in, and we talked for a while, and Forrestine had been with one of her daughters for a week, and so we were just leaving. Virginia was still talking to Forrestine, and I was walking Claude out to the car, and I had Claude by myself, and I said, Claude, I bet it was really wonderful to have Forrestine taken care of and not be with her this last week. In all of our years together, as close to where it's the only time he snapped at me, he said, that is not so. He said, I missed her so much every day. Well, why did he miss her? Because they'd spent 64 years of their life developing this deep friendship of intimacy and love and care. So even when she wasn't there mentally, he loved being with her. This is what friendship does, and this is why it's intentional. You don't decide after 50 years of marriage, wow, we should start liking each other. This is something that we build our whole marriage, and then the fruit of it is seen at the end of our marriage.
And so as we wrap up tonight, we would just want to challenge you with the question, what are you doing now that's going to set the framework for how you finish your life together? It's kind of like, what seeds are you planting that are going to eventually grow up in the garden of your life? Because, as Paul said, you don't start when you realize you're in your 70s and all of a sudden you're towards the end of your life. We better figure out how to end this thing well. It's not going to happen at that point if we begin thinking about it then. And so we're going to encourage you to think about it now. We were recently with my parents, who will have their 64th anniversary on August 16th. And my dad is probably 10 years into the journey of dementia of some form. Really a journey we never expected for this retired Rear Admiral who's kind of always kept himself in shape and all of the rest, but it is their journey. And as I think about my parents ending their life together and ending it well, even though my father is so compromised at this point, I've reflected a lot about how that happened because they were like 20 and 18 when they got married. My mom came from a family, she had lost her mom when she was only 12 years old, so she didn't have a mom that taught her much. She really got married to my dad just out of high school, and if they'd come to us for marriage counseling, we'd have told them, what are you thinking about getting married? Don't do this. But here they are, 64 years later, 7 children that they raised together, and my father's naval career was pretty big. The memory that I have of my childhood, my father would go on these deployments and he would be gone for 7 months at a time, sometimes 12 months during the Vietnam War. This is the vision I have of my mother. Every night, going in to kiss her goodnight, she would be sitting at the family dining table, which was a very large mahogany table my parents had built together because they couldn't find a table big enough for the nine of us. And she had a Mead writing tablet. You can still see them in CVS's orange cover. You know what I'm talking about. This is any of you who still write. And she would be writing pages to my dad every single night. When I'd kiss her goodnight, every single night. Besides the Mead writing tablet, she had a box of Mead envelopes. And she'd pre-addressed envelopes to my dad and numbered them. And every single night when she'd finish her lengthy letter, she would fold it up and put it into its numbered envelope, and she would drop it in the mail. And when my dad was at sea, mail was only picked up once, maybe every 2 weeks. So there are many, many days that no mail would come to our house, but she knew mail would be coming because wherever my dad was in the world, he was doing the exact same thing. He closed out his day by writing my mom and putting his letter in an envelope that was pre-numbered. And so when mail day came at our house, and 14 letters showed up at a time, my mom would know the order in which to read them, and she would know if any of them were missing, and we all knew not to bother her for several hours while she had this wonderful reunion with my dad through letters. And I've thought about that so much because we only had three girls, and there were many nights that when Paul was working long days or when he was traveling, the last thing in the world I would think of doing after getting all the children to bed was doing something for someone else. I'd feel like I was kind of spent at that point, and I deserved a break today. And so I asked my mom recently when I was down, I said, how did you do that night after night after night? Weren't there things that you wanted to do for yourself? Or weren't you just so exhausted that you just wanted to fall in bed? And she said, oh no. She said, that was my favorite time of the day. Because she said every single page of those letters was a conversation that I was having with your dad. And that was keeping our marriage alive. And you realize now you're going back in history where they couldn't text message each other, they couldn't email each other, they couldn't call each other. There was one way that they were going to stay connected while the world separated them. And I've often thought that all of that investment for all of those years are really what is showing up now with my mom's unwillingness to put my father in a home. She said, I can't do that. As long as I can take care of your father, he will stay home with me. We've been together for 64 years. I can't imagine life without him. There's very little positive coming to my mom from my dad at this point. But she said, he invested so much in our marriage for all of those years. This is the least I can do now. And so for us, it's just a huge statement about how important it is to continue to be intentional in building into our marriages, into building that friendship. For those of you who aren't married, we want you to have a vision that marriage can be one of the greatest relationships you ever, ever will have on earth. We think that's what God designed it to be, a reflection of the Godhead. There is so much in it, but if we ignore it, if we cast it aside, if we let all of the other priorities of our life squeeze it out, we'll all fall pretty far short of experiencing what God has for us.
And if, as you hear this tonight, you know, we just no longer have things in common. We have really drifted apart in our own interests. We're pursuing this, and she's pursuing this. Get together and say, what can we do together? Don't settle for parallel lives. It is not lasting. It's not going to give you the intimate satisfaction you want. Find some things that you do together. Quit doing those things which take you apart. Doesn't mean you have to do everything together, but make sure you've got some stuff that's bringing you together. I was just thinking as you were talking about mom and dad that I don't think dad has called mom by name for years, but there is such a sweetness. He wants to hold her hand, wants to just, he speaks so tenderly to her. And even though he's not, I don't know how all, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's, all this works, but there's something that's so deep within him that this is such a special woman. And he doesn't do that to every woman that comes along. This is Esther. He doesn't know she's Esther, but this is the woman that I want to connect with. And that's what God wants for us, to keep building that in our marriage. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this incredible idea you had called marriage. And we know it's a perfect idea that we have really messed up in so many ways. And we pray that we will increasingly get back to the garden, get back to what you designed us to be as husband and wife. Not for just our enjoyment, for the betterment of our children as they see us living out your design, and also as a witness to the world. This we ask in Christ's name.